Welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Uprising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello. Welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed the light on the undarkened corridors of power and shine a light ahead of us to the path where evolution is taking us. Now, the purpose of our Wiki Politiki radio podcast is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems together rather than just defend positions. So a couple of weeks ago, we had as our guest on Wiki Politiki, Eric Fogg, whose book, Wedged, How You Became a Tool of the Partisan Political Establishment and How to Start Thinking for Yourself Again. His book talks about how both political parties, both political tribes are mobilized by fear and anger to take polarized, intractable positions. I just read about another recent book by a Yale professor, John Barg, called Before You Know It, The Unconscious Reasons We Do What We Do. And this book goes into even further detail in suggesting that liberals can be made more conservative by making them feel fearful, and that conservatives more liberal by creating a sense of safety. And many of the analyses of this particular study and book would indicate that a lot more of us might be progressive than we might imagine, and that fear has been very effectively used to put people into defensive, protection, conservative, and narrow positions. Now, that brings us to this week's guest, Nick Brana. Nick is the founder and national director of the Movement for a People's Party, a coalition of organizations looking to create a new progressive political party. Nick had worked with the Bernie Sanders campaign as national political outreach coordinator, and after the primaries, he became a founding member of Bernie's Our Revolution and its first electoral manager, where he created an endorsement plan and assembled candidates. However, in early 2017, Nick quit Our Revolution, and he launched his own independent campaign to draft Bernie as an independent candidate, citing the intractability of the Democratic Party apparatus and their resistance to genuine systemic change. So, at a time when more and more people, particularly young people, are turning off to both parties, can a third party become an actual first party? Well, that's our conversation today. Welcome, Nick.
Hi, Steve. It's great to be with you.
Okay, very good. Now, I first want to let you and my listeners know that I first heard about your venture on Lee Camp's wonderful show, Redacted Tonight. And I was particularly fascinated by your pointing to times in history when new third parties became majority first parties. So at a time when everyone on the left, or I would say everybody to the left of Mitt Romney, seems majorly concerned with stopping Donald Trump's march to dictatorship, why would a third party candidacy work now?
Well, I think you have to begin by talking about the shifting consciousness that has happened over the past 15 years in the United States. There's been a profound transformation from partisan politics in terms of, you know, in terms of people's actual opinions to independent politics. Tens of millions of people have left the establishment parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, since about 2004. And that trend has continued straight through Donald Trump taking office. And despite the fact that Bernie Sanders, the most popular politician in the country, is calling for people to enter the Democratic Party. And in In connection to that, the number of Americans calling for a major third party has now gone up to almost 2 out of 3, and that is a record high, with 2/3 of Americans calling for a major new party. So now this is precisely what the American people are calling for in terms of a major new party. So really kind of consciousness among the public has advanced to the point where it is now possible to do this, you know? And in fact, it's not possible, we believe, at the Movement for a People's Party to really transform the country unless you do this, because people are looking for a level of change that is proportionate to the problems that we face. And doing things like trying to change the establishment corporate parties as has been done for decades is simply not something that inspires them. People have wised up to that, to the fact that that doesn't work.
You know, that's really true. You know, I traveled around the country during the 2016 campaign, and the question that most people were addressing was, so which candidate are you voting against? And that really seemed to be the way it was. We had these two, well, my lesser evil is lesserly evil than your lesser evil. And consequently, I knew people who voted for Bernie and then turned around and voted for Trump. And I think it was majorly because of the association with the Hillary camp with the status quo. And that's really what people are most fed up with. I want to ask you a little bit more about your own background. I saw that you began your career working for Terry McAuliffe, so clearly you understand mainstream Democratic Party politics. Tell us a bit about your own personal evolution.
Oh, yes, I absolutely. I began for about a decade working in mainstream Democratic politics. And looking for a way to produce change there. And I quickly discovered through experiences as the Deputy Voter Protection Director on the Terry McAuliffe campaign for governor in 2013 in Virginia, and also on John Kerry's Political Action Committee in my work there too. And I quickly discovered that the real guiding force between the Democratic Party as what was supposed to be the left party in the United States, the one that stands for workers and labor and people of color, I quickly discovered that its motivations were really indistinguishable from that of the Republican Party. And that is, you know, service to its big donors and ensuring that their interests, you know, always come first and above and beyond those of working people. You know, and so in those experiences, I got to work with people like Robbie Mook, who then went on to, you know, run the Hillary Clinton campaign, obviously, with John Kerry. I saw the way that all of his time was consumed while he was the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee and then senator. All of his time was consumed with raising money, you know, and he spent more time doing that than really his Senate duties. And so that was really that was very eye-opening, as was the ability of rich people to buy influence with McAuliffe and Kerry by making, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 donations, sometimes to sit down with them just for, you know, 30 minutes, and the quid pro quo between them was really obvious, and so it dawned on me in those experiences, and then later when I worked on the Bernie campaign, even more so, lobbying the superdelegates, that there would be no change inside the corporate parties. They were set up to preclude it.
So you were at least motivated to work on the Bernie campaign. So tell me about that. What was your experience first working on the primary campaign itself, and then looking at, you know, Bernie said, well, now let's all join behind Hillary. Talk a little bit more about your personal experience as you watched all of that unfold.
Right. So I stopped working. You know, I kind of stopped following the traditional Democratic career path after the Terry McAuliffe campaign. because I was very disillusioned about what I had seen in the Democratic Party after working for them for years. But it was Bernie Sanders' run in 2015 that made me go back, you know, and give it another chance. And, you know, in particular since it was Bernie, you know, that was a calling to me. And so I joined the campaign. I was the national political outreach coordinator. And so my chief job was to lobby the superdelegates and set up political meetings and win political endorsements and support for Bernie. And that experience gave me an even closer view of the way in which the party elites and the party establishment and the DNC members, which I had a job on the campaign that shouldn't even exist. The job was to persuade elites within the party to essentially bless the candidacy of Bernie Sanders. And I mean, that's wholly undemocratic, you know. There should be no position like that. But this is one of the bottlenecks set up inside the Democratic Party, of course. And so working in trying to persuade the DNC members and the superdelegates to support Bernie Sanders, in which, as I'm sure you know, we had very limited success. They were all committed to Hillary Clinton, essentially. You know, there were very few who were willing to stand up for Bernie. And even many of the ones that did had really their own kind of personal, professional motivations rather than being motivated by the policy, you know, which was the same reason that most of them supported Hillary Clinton. And so, you know, there was a complete shallowness and artificiality to the politics inside the Democratic Party, in addition to all of the structural mechanisms that I witnessed that were set up to prevent progressives from really winning. Now, the party is structured to prevent anyone, you know, who represents working people and progressives from coming to power inside of it. I'm happy to talk more about that if you want.
Oh, sure. Well, let's take a slightly different tack, because you and I met at the Unrig the System conference in New Orleans, and this was convened by Represent Us and looking at getting money out of politics. And there was a very interesting presentation by two Harvard Business School professors about what they called the political industrial complex. And that's the panoply of experts and people who are financially enmeshed in making a living, and making a very good living, out of the politics that exists right now. These two rival teams, some might call them gangs, but we'll be kind and call them teams, rival teams that are vying for the American voter, but are essentially ultimately representing the same interests. In other words, you know, one might have a kinder and gentler face on it than, let's say, Donald Trump, but essentially it's the same policies. It's the extraction of wealth from the earth without really paying it back. It's the continued wars that kept droning on during the Obama administration. So do you think that the disgust with the system that you were talking about, you know, what do you think precipitated that? Was there a time when the Democrats really did represent the working people? And what, in your, if you have any opinion on it, what might have made that switch? And now why are people switching back?
You know, you brought up a really important point, and that is that the Democratic Party, just like the Republican Party, politics is an industry, and there is an entire professional class. And you have to, you know, you have to recognize people in the U.S. that is actually exceptional and unique to the U.S. In other countries, there is not a professional political class that employs thousands upon thousands of people and consultants, you know, and businesses that have sprung up around it. That is unique to the U.S., and it's a function of, you know, the fact that we have elections that never end. Like they you know, in other countries, other Western countries, elections are limited to a few weeks. You know, in ours, you literally have a presidential election that goes for like 2 years. And so you're always campaigning. And so there is that consultant class. And so I'll give you one example, too. There is, And so the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee that manages congressional races for the Democrats, they mandate that all of their candidates spend 75% of the money that they bring in on ads and on consultants. And so what that does is that it contorts grassroots candidates and grassroots progressives into this really ad-heavy, political industry-friendly, consultant-friendly campaign, rather than being like a door-knocking, and community-building exercise. It's just an exercise in, transferring money to consultants, like on K Street. So that is a good example. But to answer your question, there was a time when the Democratic Party was closer to what working people stood for. I don't think that it has ever actually held the interests of working people, even from its founding with Andrew Jackson. It was really born as a corrupt institution, and it remains so today. But it was certainly closer during the times of the New Deal, and actually there was far more support for the Democratic Party back then. And you even had another thing that I think people might not realize, especially when you look at when you watch the mainstream media in the U.S., which has like no historical memory whatsoever. It's constantly rewriting itself. It cannot remember anything that has happened like 2 weeks ago. That's the span of attention. And so, people don't realize how far the country has moved to the right over the past several decades, particularly from the New Deal era. And so you think we have all of this technology, we have all of this new productivity, and yet the country, people are poorer now, inequality is higher now. And Eisenhower said that the New Deal policies, which were dismantled by the Bill Clinton administration later, he said that, there would be no sane Republican would run against them, would run against banking protection, and would run against welfare. And of course, now we know both the Democrats and the Republicans do. Richard Nixon in 1971 proposed a universal basic income for everyone of about $11,000 per family. A federal jobs guarantee used to be a mainstream political opinion in the United States among politicians. And so now those things all sound like, like utopian progressive fairy tales or something. But it's a reflection of how far both parties, the entire political spectrum, the Overton window has moved to the right.
Very good. Well, we're going to take a little break very shortly, and when we get back with Nick Branagh, we'll talk more about how to spread the good news to the people who are ready for something new. This is Steve Behrman, WikiPoliticky. We're talking about a new first political party in this country.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
I'm Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called the Bukavu in the Congo. We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day. People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything. I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at EmbraceRefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
We're back. We're back with Nick Brana, who's the founder and national director of the Movement for a People's Party, looking to create a brand new first party in this country. Nick, of course, obviously, you know, you've described a lot of the things that we're up against. We're up against huge amounts of money. We're up against the media being controlled by very few people, meaning the conversation, the parameters of the conversation being controlled by few people. And yet, you're talking about the level of disillusionment and disgust and frustration with politics as usual and two-party system. What is the strategy to mobilize this enough people to actually create this movement as an effective political party?
That is a great question, and I'm really happy to get to it. Because as the theme of your show, you know, reinforces, we as progressives and those who know that, you know, a better world is possible, it's not enough for us to change the system by trying to criticize what exists. But we need to offer, you know, what Naomi Klein calls our yes. You know, what does our alternative vision look like? And so that, I think, is the first step, is that we saw in 2016, in the 2016 election, what happens when the left doesn't have kind of like a cohesive yes answer. And what happens is that when the right offers, you know, what it's seen as the only kind of alternative to establishment politics, then that is where people go. They go to people like Donald Trump. And so that's what building a new party is about. It's about offering our own positive, rousing vision that can actually mobilize people and tell them, you could be living like this. You know, you could be living in a world where all of our energy is generated by renewable sources, by wind and tidal and geothermal and rooftop solar. You know, we don't have to have fossil fuels anymore. You could be living in a world where healthcare is provided to you as a human right, and you don't have to be concerned about where, you know, whether you're going to be able to pay your medical bills or whether you're going to be able to pay for groceries, you know, that particular week. I mean, we could be living in a world where you earn a living wage and where we reduce working hours, because now we have the ability to automate so much labor, and we could reduce really the amount of labor that that people are doing. John Maynard Keynes said that by the year 2000, we would be working 15 hours a week. Well, you know, so the promise of that technology and that potential is there for all of us to realize what visionaries like Martin Luther King and Franklin Roosevelt conceived of many decades before. And that is like a second bill of human rights, a second bill of rights in the U.S., of economic rights. In 1944, Franklin Roosevelt spelled it out as his post-war vision, after the Second World War, that is what the U.S. would pursue, in instituting a second economic bill of rights that would guarantee food and water and health care and shelter and clothing and education and recreation and a good job and freedom from monopolies to everyone in the country.
That, you know, he called that the four freedoms. in that speech. They were all freedoms. Freedom from want was one of the freedoms that you're talking about. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm sorry that I interrupted you on that. I think you're absolutely right that and there's something that happened. And you may know about this. A lot of people don't. And I was a history major and I didn't know about this until I watched Oliver Stone's series, The Untold History of the U.S. And he talks about the 1944 Democratic Party convention. And everybody knew that Franklin D. Roosevelt was in very, very, very poor health. And even though they were about to nominate him and then elect him to an unprecedented fourth term, most people realized he was not going to live through that term. Franklin Roosevelt's personal choice for vice president was his vice president from 1940, Henry A. Wallace. And Henry Wallace was a true visionary. He was somebody who more than 80 years ago had that vision that you're talking about now that influenced FDR to do the speech on the four freedoms and, you know, talk about these economic rights that nobody had talked about before. But a funny thing happened. You know, it wasn't that funny. Because FDR was so physically debilitated, he was not really able to offer very much influence in the 1944 Democratic Convention. And so instead of Henry Wallace, who was the people's choice and was everybody's choice, was FDR's choice, they were able to finagle Harry Truman, who was a machine party politician from Kansas City and much more malleable by the political industrial, the military industrial complex pretty much. And so instead of having a visionary to lead the world through the United Nations in the post-Nazi Germany, we had a system that very sadly adopted not just the Nazi scientists, but unfortunately some of their practices, and so we turned into much more of an empire at the end of that time, and it was the Democratic Party at that time in New Deal America that essentially turned off that vision, turned out the light on that vision until now. So I want to put a highlight underneath what you just said in regards to having a vision, because what the Democratic Party is doing and falling into that their brand, which is vote for us, we're not as bad as the other guys, this whole idea of resisting Donald Trump, it puts Donald Trump in the news. It puts him front and center. It makes the conversation about them. It makes the conversation about what we don't want instead of having that vision. So I really want to emphasize for people listening that what you said about having a vision is one of the key pieces. So say more about that.
You're right, and you brought Oliver Stone's series as an excellent one, The Untold History of the United States. And the source of Wallace's popularity back then as Roosevelt's vice president was his vision. You know, that he had a vision of a peaceful, cooperative world, you know, where the U.S. would act as a real ambassador of really elevating the world, you know, out of poverty, out of need, out of want, freedom from want. And that is what made him so popular. And that is what we need today. Because that is really what galvanizes people. It is that hope, you know, and the ability to simultaneously see how the world that they have is so, you know, is so decrepit and really causes so much suffering. And at the same time, see a vivid and viable and attainable, you know, tangible alternative that they feel is at their fingertips, knowing that that's possible. And that is today. We could live in a radically different world, you know? And I think that it's going to take that kind of vision, that kind of great vision of saying, we don't need to choose winners and losers anymore. You know, we don't need to choose that someone is, you know, going to have to go hungry while someone lives a good life. I mean, we have the resources and the technology today to provide for everyone. We don't have to make that choice. And in fact, we had it back 70 years ago when Roosevelt said it and when Martin Luther King said it, you know, 20 years after that. So that is, I think, our first task, is to make people see that vision and offer an alternative. Because you're right, as the only thing that the Democrats do is that they say, we're not Trump. And that doesn't inspire anyone. And it also creates a false kind of account of history, because it makes Trump seem exceptional and different from the rest of American politics and, you know, in history, Obama, Bush, and Clinton. Whereas really, Trump just has exacerbated versions of policies that they had implemented before. And so he really just is the next step, you know, in kind of a spiral into oligarchy. And so to break that, you have to show people there's another world that's possible, and really galvanize people towards going to that. And as well as that, so in addition to that, you know, and that is really, I think, it's such a central ingredient, and that's why I wanted to bring it up first, is having that vision. And then talking about the organizing, you know, so it is the kind of center of worker power in the United States has always been in organized labor. It has been labor unions, which have really been under a nonstop assault ever since FDR declared the 40-hour work week, and ever since, you know, they passed labor protections in the mid-30s by both parties, who have taken them from 35% unionization in the country to about 11% of workers unionized in the U.S. Yet they are the greatest source of working class power in America. And so another step is, I think, organizing the many labor unions that are now coming to the conclusion that neither the Democratic or the Republican Party has their interest at heart. And I'll give you an example. At the AFL-CIO conference last year, in 2017, the AFL-CIO did something unprecedented. And it passed a resolution that said that it would no longer be subscribing to lesser of two evils politics. And it passed a second resolution it's very profound.
A big wow.
And there were some that wanted it, there were some that didn't, but the ones that wanted it really, you know, forced it through because they were that determined for it. And there was a second resolution which was just as profound. And it said that the AFL-CIO and its member unions are going to devote resources now to exploring independent politics, building an independent party, and alternatives to the two corporate parties. And so that's a big transformation from the AFL-CIO and the many unions which have traditionally supported the Democratic Party, and that represents a big breaking away from them. And so it's important to be, I think, for those of us who represent and work with social movements, to be working and forming those alliances and those coalitions with organized labor, and to be bringing together, you know, to kind of serve as the magnet and the attractor for all of those different people across the country, those two-thirds of people, many of which are working people who have been hit so hard by the policies of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, and bringing them together, creating that attractor so we can pool our energy, pool our force, and start building this major new party. I'm happy to talk more about that, but I want to let you break in.
Well, you know, I really appreciate that about the unions and the resurgence of that understanding. Back in when I was in my early 30s, I taught at UAW locals in the Detroit area, and for the weekend college. And I found surprising that how many people didn't know that other people died so that they could have what they have, so that they could have their union rights. And I think what you said earlier about how there's been an intentional stupidization program that has really kept people from contextualizing current events and putting them into historical perspective. And so if it happened 2 weeks ago, it's old news. If it happened 20 years ago, it's really old news. And so I think what you're really talking about requires a new independent way of educating people and also speaking beyond these political divides, because already the AFL-CIO recognizes that our interests are way bigger than aligning ourselves automatically with the Democratic Party. So the next question is, how do we reach people and how do we create these new conversations about possibility and about moving beyond these two obsolete and obsoletal parties?
I like the way you refer to them and reframe the thinking about them. Another really important aspect of, I think, being able to successfully break away from the two parties, something that we saw when the Republican Party was able to actually replace the Republican Party was founded in the 1850s, and it replaced the Whig Party, which had been a major party at the time. So this was an independent party founded on abolition that replaced a pro-slavery party after the Whig Party had really abandoned its base and refused to relinquish slavery in its platform in the election of 1852. And something that made the Republican Party successful in replacing the Whigs was that they managed to take a number of different professional resources, elected officials, candidates, staff with knowledge of running political campaigns, and bring them over to the new Republican Party. And so I think that is important in a number of ways, and something that we need to do today as well, in that we need to bring over those progressive candidates inside the Democratic Party, in particular, perhaps even inside the Republican Party, and certainly people who are independents, but bringing those folks into the effort to create a major new party. And so, for example, Tim Canova, who was a major candidate who is now contesting W. Wasserman Schultz in Florida for Congress, in 2016, he ran against her as a Democrat. Now, many of our organizers spoke to him for months, and he decided to run as an independent now. And so that is a big, that is a big leading galvanizing figure who brings lots of resources and knowledge out of the Democratic Party. And I think that's what it'll take. It'll take more people taking that kind of principled stand and encouraging them to do that. And I think there are real openings to do that as with the candidates. There's lots of really great candidates who are running in the primaries that you mentioned at the top of the hour. And they now, we can reach out to them about joining a major new party.
Very good. Well, we'll be talking more with Nick Brana as we wrap up our final segment, and we'll talk more about how this can unfold over the next 2 to 4 years. So we'll be back shortly.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living. A chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
We're back with Nick Brenna. We're talking about the movement for a new political party. A question. What about the Green Party? What's your take on the Green Party? What about them?
Yes. So the Green Party, thankfully, with the work that they've done, has really blazed the path for what we're doing. But in the 1850s, for example, when the Republican Party replaced the Whigs, there had been a number of progressive policies that had existed before, abolitionist parties, the Liberty Party, the Free Soil Party, but neither of them were the one that ultimately replaced the Whig Party. It took the emergence of something new at just the right moment that was really considered viable and that could attract many people in order to produce that breakthrough, to be the party that replaced an establishment party. And I think that's what you need again, because unfortunately, the Green Party has a really intractable stigma of being unviable, and it also has a name that I think reinforces that stigma. And if it wanted to change that name, you know, we've discussed with a number of folks who are in the Green Party about that possibility. Then we discovered that they would have to get ballot access again in every single state. And so they would essentially have to start over. And so the problem is that the name Green Party right now makes it seem as if the party is concerned more with kind of niche environmental concerns, so to speak, you know, than really like the bread and butter livelihood of people's everyday lives. And so it really hobbles it. And so the Green Party is unfortunately in this catch-22 where it cannot be this kind of breakthrough party with the kind of name that it has and the branding and for other reasons. But it can't change that without having to start over as a party.
Yeah, I figured that that's pretty much the way it is. They already have their brand, and there it was. It can't be, it'd be like trying to revitalize the Democratic Party. What is the next step in actually creating this coherence? I want to go back and say something that relates to what you said earlier. I'm going to reinforce it, that what happened in the 2016 election was that the Trump people were coherent with one another. They had an actual viable vision, not our vision, but they had a vision. They had something that they were all focused on. And the Democrats were simply, you know, as the Bible says, where there's no vision, the people perish. We are the people. Again, they have no vision. And so how do you see this playing out in 2018 and 2020? Will the party have a name? Will it have a coherent platform? And how is it going to step away from the traditional idea of progressivism and really align itself as well with populism, like the old farm labor party of 120, 130 years ago, of the Grange movement and all of that. One more question to throw in there, and you can answer them in whatever orders you like. any candidates running as independents in the election in November who have a chance to defeat a Democrat or Republican opponent?
Well, in that first one, I would mention Tim Canova, who we've endorsed in 2016. I mean, in as an independent in 2018, in the Florida 23rd district. And to talk about those kinds of, you know, the progression to forming a new party, I think I'd say there are a series of steps that we've kind of identified, you know, and I'm happy to talk about them. And so we've already talked about some of those first steps. Firstly, you need to kind of do an examination of where you stand as a country, and really ask yourself, you know, honestly, whether there is the will and the appetite to do this. And for many decades, there wasn't. But now you have a completely different national environment where people have lost confidence in institutions like the government, banks, big business, the education system, the justice system. I mean, just across the board, it is confidence in these like bedrock institutions that constitute our society is now at historic lows. And you have that record high 2/3 of people who are calling for a major new party. You have almost half of the country, 45% of Americans, who are now independent rather than Democrat or Republican. So almost as many as Democrats and Republicans combined. So now you have that, you know, there is the national environment to do this now. People are really clamoring for this now. 2/3 of people are saying that they aren't even going to vote in the midterm elections because the Democrats and Republicans are so corrupt. So the first, I think that's the first task, is to assess, you know, whether it's really viable and whether it can be done, whether there's the desire out there, that palpable desire, and there is. And then I believe that it is to kind of popularize the idea, to change hearts and minds, to persuade people of the need for building a people's party, parties accountable to working people, and then to activate those people and build a mass movement out of them as well, to get them actively involved in building the party, and then to do something which I think the progressive movement right now has done very well, and that is to unify around a platform. You know, so we've been fortunate that to a great degree, I think we, the movement as a whole and working people as a whole, when you ask them in an opinion polls, agree about what kinds of policies we want to see. We want to see healthcare guaranteed for everyone. We want to see education guaranteed for everyone. We want to see kind of a floor at which people can live, you know, with something like a universal basic income and a guaranteed job, and also a living wage. And we want to see banks broken up. You know, we want to see them not able to crash the economy in the way that they did again. We want to see money out of politics. So we have that agreement, you know, as a country, not just as a progressive movement, about what we need to do, what we need to accomplish. Next,
yes.
I think,
yeah.
is
good.
Is what we're working on, and that is to network organizations, to network unions, and community groups into a coalition of those who agree that we need an independent political solution, and to support independent candidates who can be leaders and partners in forming that new party, which is what we're doing now as well. And organize around progressive issues with those groups too, and build, you know, build power, build grassroots power for electing candidates. And it is as well what we talked about, that it is bringing and pulling, you know, influencers and resources out of the establishment parties, and so leading progressive candidates and luminaries and thinkers like Cornel West, who's a supporter of ours, and also. Then begin the process of running candidates. And I think in particular, where you can begin, the best places to begin, and a lot of the people who were central to forming the Labor Party in 1996, who we've been working with, they they have come to the conclusion that the best place to begin is by running community labor candidates. And so by running candidates in cities for municipal positions and state legislative positions, in particular because they can run nonpartisan at the municipal level, and they can have support from their local unions, and you could put together, and we would love to do this, a national slate of independent community labor candidates. And that would be a really powerful thing, and a really powerful statement of labor's declaration of independence from the establishment party as well. And with those successes, of electing people, you know, to a mayorship, county commissioner, you know, things like city council, state legislature, you can be, you just a few victories there would really reinvigorate and inspire unions in that direction, in the independent political direction, you know, and others, because you're essentially creating an alternative model and you're proving its viability, an alternative electoral model to running in the Democratic Party over and over and over again and getting blocked. And then from there, you can consolidate, launch state parties in the most, you know, independent states and the parties that support these policies the most, and then network those state parties into a nationally viable party. And this kind of model and plan draws a lot of lessons from independent political efforts in the past, and in particular in the ways that the Republican Party was able to replace the Whigs.
Very, very interesting. And I think that this is really how things take place nowadays. You know, you can't really impose – we have a new party from the top down. It really has to build itself from the bottom up, because there's you want to create the best practices right there at the grassroots level and then apply them from one place to the next. And so this non-hierarchical networking that you're talking about, it's kind of the end and the means are really the same, aren't they?
Exactly. That is the idea. Because what we need to do is not just create a new party, but we need to reinvent the concept of the party. Because the Democratic and the Republican parties, they're entirely hierarchical, top-down. They're controlled by, you know, a small cadre of elites like inside the DNC, and they really have no connection to the grassroots whatsoever. Like the platform is not determined by the voters. The leadership, you know, is not elected by the voters. And so you're right about that. And the other thing that I would say, too, is that I actually don't believe that this is going to be a process that takes many, 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 many years, you know, or like I don't think this is like a 30-year plan, because I think that we're approaching this point in society where as people leave the two establishment parties, you know, they continue to lose their membership. More people continue calling for a major new party. You know, the political system becomes unstable because the two parties no longer hold people. And there's really this vast ocean of independence. And even most of the people who remain inside the two parties are saying, I would really rather vote for someone else. And so historically, what we've seen is that, you know, pressure builds up for a long time as problems aren't taken care of, you know, as working people are really pushed to the margins. And then change happens very quickly, you know, when it does. And so the Republican Party replaced the Whigs in just 4 years. It went from not existing to totally replacing them in Congress, in the Senate, state legislatures, and electing Abraham Lincoln president. And I think that we can do the same thing here.
You know, who was it who said that there's nothing as powerful as an idea whose time has come? And, you know, the timing for this, given the level of disgust that people have had with the with this past election, and, you know, you're watching it with the Me Too movement. You're watching it with the young people anti-gun movement. People are going, you know what? We're tired of not being represented. We're tired of having a system that operates for its own benefit. So this is really a very, I appreciate your strategy, because the strategy itself will be what creates the activity in the party. The people that we don't know who they are right now will end up being candidates, and there may be a candidate for president in 2020 who actually is able to bring people from, certainly from the progressive side, probably from all sides. And there's a lot of work to be done in terms of election reform and so on. But I think that a party that really focuses on changing the rules of the game so that it's not rigged against we the people is what people are wanting right now, and all of these other benefits that you're talking about. Like people are very much, the Democrats are finding that Obamacare is universally unpopular because more people want the real thing. They want universal health care.
Yeah.
Well, our time is up. Nick Brana, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us and creating the movement for a People's Party. Nick, we hope to talk with you again.
Thank you, Steve. It's been a real pleasure. Come and find us at forpeoplesparty.org.
Good. And it's on our WikiPolitiki website and the Ohm Times website. You can get the link there. This is Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki. Thank you, and catch you next week.